Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Two attacks in Nigeria are blamed on Boko Haram militants. The conviction of a Congolese warlord is upheld by an international court. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Suspected Islamic extremists attacked two northeastern Nigerian state capitals today. Witnesses in Maiduguri say two explosions ripped through a crowded market. According to a report by the French news agency AFP, at least 10 people were killed. The suicide bombers were said to be two women. Earlier in the day, residents of Damaturu said militants attacked a police facility in that city. Residents, including Yobe State University students, fled to hide in the bush. Nigeria's Defense Ministry spokesman, Major General Chris Olukale, told reporters that troops backed by the Air Force were fighting off the militants in Damaturu. The AFP reports that the International Criminal Court has upheld the conviction of Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga on charges of using child soldiers. The court handed down its verdict today. Four men suspected of trafficking in heroin were freed on bail today in Kenya. The AFP reports that two Kenyans, one Indian and one Pakistani, are awaiting extradition to the United States. They were arrested last month with 98 packets of the drug. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is praising the progress the world has made in combating AIDS, but warns that the gains remain fragile. In a statement for today's World AIDS Day, Mr. Ban highlighted the importance of addressing gaps in access to treatment, particularly for children and young women. This is VOA News. The AFP reports three policemen were wounded today when two car bombs went off in the eastern Libyan town of Ajabiya. The blast occurred in the parking lot of a police station which houses the town's surveillance control center. Reuters reports three people in Egypt have died of bird flu. That brings this year's H5N1 death toll in the country to six, according to Egypt's health ministry. That's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He is threatening to call new elections if government ministers don't stop their attacks on him over nationalist legislation and budgetary matters. According to the Associated Press, Mr. Netanyahu is demanding that the ministers stop their subversion of the government. The dissent in government is causing a crisis that could topple the current government. The AFP reports that a new round of climate talks opened today in Peru. The Lima meeting seeks to pave the way for a broad agreement 1 year from now at a planned meeting in Paris, where nearly 200 nations will try to reach an agreement on ways to reduce carbon pollution. Reuters reports Ukraine is asking for military aid from Europe and the United States. Foreign Minister Pavlo Klimkin says the arms would help deter pro-Russian separatists in the nation's rebellious east. He says a ceasefire agreement signed with Russia and the rebels is being violated daily. Reuters reports that Turkey is close to agreeing to let the United States use its air bases in a campaign against Islamic militants in Syria. The Reuters report cites an article in today's Wall Street Journal. Islamic State militants killed at least 16 Iraqi border guards in a dawn assault today on a remote outpost near the Syrian frontier. At least four other guards were wounded in the attack on their headquarters at Al-Walid. Violence in Hong Kong between pro-democracy protesters and police has closed government offices and shut down parliament. Hundreds of Hong Kong pro-democracy protesters fought with police as they positioned themselves outside government headquarters. Results from parliamentary elections in Moldova show parties that want to pursue closer ties to Europe are leading those who want closer ties with Russia. The World Food Program has suspended its effort to distribute food vouchers to Syrian refugees in five countries. The suspension is due to a lack of funding. The UN agency says it needs $64 million to meet the needs of some 1.7 million refugees in December. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes are down at this hour. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yis Ruhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
December 1st is World AIDS Day. In the 35 years of the epidemic, about 80 million people have become infected with HIV, and nearly 40 million have died. But great progress has been made in recent years in preventing and treating the disease. UNAIDS has set a goal of ending the epidemic by 2030.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news, in northern Nigeria, Boko Haram suicide bombers are blamed for attacks today in the capital cities of Borno and Yobe states.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Gabon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, December 1st, is World AIDS Day. In the 35 years of the epidemic, about 80 million people have become infected with HIV and nearly 40 million have died. But great progress has been made in recent years in preventing and treating the disease. UNAIDS, the joint United Nations program on HIV/AIDS, has set a goal of ending the epidemic by 2030. An advocacy group says a strategic plan and much funding are needed to achieve that goal. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
In a videotaped message for World AIDS Day, UNAIDS Executive Director Michelle Sidibe asked people to reflect on the lives lost to Ebola.
Ebola reminded us what we were going through at the beginning of the fight against HIV. People were hiding themselves. They were scared. Stigma, discrimination. We were not having any hope.
Sidibe says that thanks to global solidarity, social mobilization, and civil society activism, tragedy has been turned into opportunity. He says the lives of millions of people infected with HIV have been saved due to greater access to antiretroviral drugs. UNAIDS has what it calls a fast-track strategy to end the epidemic by 2030. The first phase sets targets for the year 2020, known as 90-90-90. Mitchell Warren is executive director of the HIV advocacy group, AVAC.
Coming out of the AIDS conference this year in Melbourne, Australia, UNAIDS talked about this goal of getting 90% of people who are infected with HIV to know their status, 90% of them to get on treatment, and 90% of those on treatment to be what we call virologically suppressed, that the antiretroviral drugs would suppress the virus.
Research shows the more HIV is suppressed in the body, the less likely a person is to infect someone else.
That's really great news, but if you do the math, going from 90-90-90, it works out to about 73% of people who are infected would need to be virologically suppressed. But keep in mind that even in the United States right now, less than 30% of people who are infected are virologically suppressed. So there's a huge amount of effort to translate this kind of rhetoric, this good idea of 90-90-90 into practice.
Warren says treatment alone won't be enough to make 90-90-90 a reality.
One of the points that AVAC brings up in our AVAC report is called HIV prevention on the line. Because to get us truly to zero new infections in the long term, which is the ultimate goal, is going to require prevention. So to get on that line to zero, we need HIV prevention. But that title also carries a double meaning, because right now, given all of this focus on 90-90-90, we believe that HIV prevention is actually in jeopardy.
The AVAC leader says prevention should be given greater emphasis in the UNAIDS strategy.
We need to be sure that we have very clear targets and resources and programs that keep prevention high on the priority along with treatment so that we actually can think about ending this epidemic.
Warren says ambitious plans like 90-90-90 can cost a lot of money.
Unfortunately, the funding is not there, and I think that's probably the most important reality check here at World AIDS Day. So we are at real risk of setting targets that aren't resourced, and therefore those targets could be unmet simply by the incredible resource gap at the global level. So we have these amazing opportunities to have impact on the epidemic, but it doesn't come for free.
Warren says knowledge gained during the HIV/AIDS epidemic can be applied to West Africa's Ebola crisis. Both diseases have bred fear and discrimination.
Having a clear human rights-based response is just as important as having a good public health response. And that's lesson number one. Lesson number two is that while we do all the important work of caring and treating for people, having a research agenda is critical. And the third important lesson, I think, that draws a connection between HIV and Ebola is that strong public health systems are critical for any infectious disease.
Nigerian health officials say a big reason it quickly ended its Ebola outbreak was the health infrastructure that had been set up to deal with polio and HIV. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
As South Africa joins the rest of the world in commemorating World AIDS Day, experts say women below the age of 25 in the country have a high HIV infection rate. Studies show they are getting the virus from older men. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Lolo Brigitte Tsupa, 30, is a young South African woman who learned she is HIV positive at the age of 23. She says her craving for a fast and high-flying life led her to look for a man who could provide that for her. But Tsupa says she got more than that.
I met this man who had money, drove nice cars, and the man was very old enough to be my father. He would buy me things, my gifts, and he would take me out. That's the life I wanted to live, and I didn't have that at home. Anyways, that's where I got the virus from.
Tsupa's story is similar to that of 28-year-old Brenda Masango. Masango says she discovered she is HIV positive in 2007 while still a student at the University of Tshwane. She says it all started when her parents cut down their financial support to punish her bad behavior.
I had to buy clothes for myself. I had to see what I eat at school. So I dated a bigger person to me, like a man. So it came where he says to me, I'm giving you money and I give you a lot of money. So I ended up having sex with that guy, not using a condom. So I think that's where I contracted HIV.
Experts say 6.4 million people out of South Africa's 50 million population are HIV positive. They say HIV prevalence in young women is rising at a faster rate than in young men in the same age group. Females between the age of 15 to 24 years are four times more likely to contract HIV than their male counterparts. The infection rate amongst females 15 to 19 years is 5.6%. The gap grows even wider in the 20 to 24 years category. Studies show women in this group become HIV positive 5 years earlier than their male counterparts. In the 20 to 24-year group, the infection rate amongst males is 5.1% compared to 17.4% for women. Dr. Farid Abdullah, the chief executive officer of the South African National AIDS Council, says this statistics is worrying.
About one quarter of all new infections is in young women between the ages of 15 and 24. And we believe that they are being infected by older men in exchange for gifts, for clothing, what we call transactional sex. Because older men have a higher accumulated risk of HIV.
Abdullah says South Africa needs multiple programs to deal with intergenerational sex, including poverty alleviation programs and sex education campaigns directed at young girls. Poshia Serote is the national coordinator at the Treatment Action Campaign, a Johannesburg-based HIV and AIDS advocacy organization. She says the government policy that allows girls as young as 12 to have sex, use contraceptives, and abort unwanted pregnancies without the consent of their parents is to blame for the high level of HIV infection among young girls.
It's more like we are setting them for failure to be HIV positive. And once they are HIV positive, it becomes a mess. Because she's pregnant, two, she's young. That is setting for a failure. We push them to have sex, but we are not giving them a space to practice the responsibility to the rights that we're giving them.
Experts also agree that it is not all gloom and doom for South Africa. The country has the largest antiretroviral treatment rollout in the world and has drastically reduced mother-to-child HIV infection rate from 8% in 2008 to around 2%. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization says Liberia and Guinea have met the December 1st targets of isolating 70% of people infected with Ebola and safely burying 70% of those who die. WHO's Dr. Bruce Aylward says the ambitious plan to stop the Ebola outbreak in West Africa can quickly reduce what he calls the yawning gap between disease levels and the capacity to respond. However, the UN's Anthony Banbury says conditions have grown worse in Sierra Leone. Infection rates are soaring with up to 500 new cases per week. He also says Sierra Leone desperately needs more beds to treat Ebola patients. The head of the UN mission says 65% of new cases are occurring in Freetown, the capital, and the northern Port Loko district. Banbury says health workers will not be able to lower the infection rate unless the nation gets more treatment centers and increases the number of teams trained to safely bury the dead.
The country has only one-fourth of the burial teams it needs to bury those who die of Ebola. Local cultural practices call for women to wash the bodies of women before they are taken for burial. There are very few women on the trained burial teams, so untrained women, family members and friends now wash the bodies before they call health workers to take away the diseased. The result is greater spread of the virus.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heap, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Today is World AIDS Day. In the 35 years of the epidemic, about 80 million people have become infected with HIV and nearly 40 million have died. And the World Health Organization says Liberia and Guinea have met the December 1st targets of safely burying 70% of those infected with Ebola. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
In northern Nigeria, Boko Haram suicide bombers are blamed for attacks today in the capital cities of Borno and Yobe states. Witnesses in Maiduguri say two explosions ripped through a crowded market. No death toll has been reported yet, but witnesses describe many dead and wounded in the blast. Residents of the capital of Yobe State say heavily armed men attacked Damaturu with explosions and gunfire. Gunmen have reached the city center, according to a Nigerian television reporter's account to VOA. Another source told the French news agency that a police barracks had been destroyed. On Friday, Boko Haram fighters killed more than 100 at the central mosque in Kano, the largest city in northern Nigeria, and the palace of the Emir of Kano. The Emir is the second highest religious authority in Nigeria. He recently called on people to do whatever is necessary to defend themselves from Boko Haram. Also today, the U.S. Embassy reports the Nigerian government has told the U.S. military to stop training a battalion of Nigerian soldiers in the battle against Boko Haram. The embassy says it regrets Abuja's decision, which is apparently a protest against Washington's refusal to sell helicopter gunships to Nigeria.
UN humanitarian officials say in the first 9 months of this year, nearly 11.5 million people were displaced in East Africa. That's an increase of about 1.4 million since March. About 2.5 million of the displaced are refugees. The rest are displaced within their own countries, also known as internally displaced persons. The number of IDPs has increased by more than 15% over the last 6 months due to conflict and insecurity in Sudan and South Sudan. The number of refugees has increased more than 8.5% this year. That's mostly due to refugees fleeing South Sudan for Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, and Uganda.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, reports over 5,000 migrants rescued from the Mediterranean Sea in 13 rescue operations in the past 2 weeks. Italy's Mayor Nostrum and the EU's Triton programs have rescued the migrants. Most migrants are from sub-Saharan Africa and sail in unseaworthy rubber dinghies in the Channel of Sicily. Flavio Di Giacomo is an IOM spokesperson in Rome. He spoke with me about what happens to the migrants once they arrive in Italy and what the future holds as the Mare Nostrum operation will end at the end of this year.
These people are now being transferred to reception centers in Italy. They are identified, of course, as said by the law, and then they are being transferred to the reception centers in Italy, in all the region, in the north and the south of the country. Many of them are asking for asylum, so they will have to follow the asylum procedure in the country. The point is that the majority of those migrants, they are coming from sub-Saharan Africa. At least we are talking about migrants coming from Gambia, Mali, Senegal, Nigeria, and Ghana. We have also registered specific landing of migrants coming from Syria, who, for the first time, as far as I remember, they didn't come from Libya or Egypt, but they did come from Turkey. They arrived on a commercial ship and they are rescued in the water off the Sicilian coast.
When they do arrive there and they ask for asylum, then what is the process for them?
As you know, there are over 160,000 migrants who arrived in Italy this year. Some of them who left the country, actually, they escaped from the reception center in order to meet relatives in Northern Europe or Germany. Many Syrians did so. But generally speaking, migrants are transferred to reception centers for asylum seekers and other facilities who have been used by the Italian government for this purpose, because with so many migrants, there's an emergency plan which is going on in the country. And then they are transferred to these reception centers, and then there will be the commissions who are entitled to interview them and to understand all these migrants can be entitled to with some kind of protection. Generally speaking, in Italy, well, at least until last year, 70% of the migrants who ask for asylum, they receive some kind of protection, not only the refugee status, but also other kind of international protection.
How is Italy handling this type of influx of people over the past year?
It has been an emergency. We are not talking about the numbers. Yeah, 160,000 migrants are a lot, but if you compare with the refugees going to Lebanon, which are over a million, almost 2 million who went to Turkey, of course, 160,000 migrants. It's a relevant number, but not such a big number if we look from a wider perspective. The point is that it is an emergency in terms of operational emergency, because those people arrive by sea, so in very difficult and risky situation. There are a lot of shipwrecks, unfortunately, and the Italian authorities have to cope to this large influx of migrants that need to be rescued, and then they need to receive appropriate and adequate reception at the moment of the arrival. So it has been a very, very hard year for the Italian government, and the Mare Nostrum operation was a very efficient response to this emergency, actually, because many migrants have been saved and rescued while their boat was about to sink. It's quite difficult to provide adequate reception to these migrants. Sometimes, like in these last 10 days, there's 5,000 arrivals can happen. And you can imagine that all these thousands of migrants are arriving in 2 or 3 or 4 harbors in the country. So it's very difficult to provide adequate assistance to all of them, of course.
Once the migrants have been processed at the reception center, are they then given food and shelter?
Well, the migrants are identified. They receive a medical checkup before landing, when they are on the boat, generally speaking. And then they are transferred to this reception center when they are provided with food and other not food items.
And it just seems like this is going to continue to be an ongoing process, including with the shipwrecks that are occurring and many people losing their lives. So going forward into the next year, what do you think needs to be done?
Well, we are quite worried because, you know, starting from January, the Mare Nostrum operation will end and only the Triton operation will be in place. And the Triton operation, which is a European Union operation, of course, will have the power to patrol only within 30 miles of the Italian coast, with a specific mandate to control the European Union's border, while the Italian Mare Nostrum operation used to carry out search and rescue operation in international waters beyond the 30-mile limit. So for the moment, it is very difficult to say what impact the end of Mare Nostrum will have on a life-saving operation carried out at sea, but the flows of migrants will probably continue for some time. So we think that the risk of shipwrecks will not decrease. So we are very worried for next year.
That was IOM spokesperson Flavio Di Giacomo. He spoke with me from Rome.
UN agencies, the Somali government, and the Somali Journalists Union are working to address the problem of censorship and the threat of violence against journalists in Somalia. Abdulaziz Bello has more from Mogadishu.
This year, at least three journalists have been killed in Somalia and three more badly wounded. Abdirizak Ilmi, a local TV journalist, was the latest victim. Unknown gunmen shot him at close range outside his Mogadishu home. He survived but suffered severe wounds. The government says now is the time to address the safety of journalists. Mustafa Duhlo is Somalia's Minister of Information.
As you are all aware, Somalia is moving forward to become a peaceful nation. Therefore, this is the best time to address all the challenges such as impunity, safety of journalists, and understanding the need to develop Somali media, as each country's development depends on how its media are free.
Journalists in Somalia have been meeting with key partners to discuss their security concerns. At this session, representatives from the United Nations, the Somali government, and the Somali Journalists Union jointly expressed their concerns over attacks on the media. The UN's Cassandra Nelson pointed out that Somalia is among the top 10 deadliest countries for journalists in the world.
And despite significant progresses that have been made in Somalia, assassinations, imprisonments, harassment still continues, and often without impunity. And that's what we are here to talk about together as a group.
The Journalists Union Mohammed Ibrahim outlined his group's concern.
The impunity of, is giving more opportunity for the killers to do more attacks against the journalists. So this conference will mainly focus on the issue of safety and the security of journalists and the current freedom of expression situation.
The journalists also debated a controversial media law that awaits parliamentary approval. For months now, journalists have expressed concern over some parts of the law which they say restrict freedom of the press while not properly addressing their safety. UN officials share these reservations. Jaco Dutoit is with UNESCO's Regional Office for East Africa.
Journalists are extremely important in our society, and without information that they provide us, we will not be able to make informed decisions.
In addition to violence, journalists face the problem of government censorship. The Somali government recently shut down two independent radio stations accused of inciting violence among Somalis. Several journalists are also in prisons across the country. In Somaliland, a self-declared independent nation to the north, authorities have increased their control of the media by shutting down leading newspapers and imprisoning editors. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Today is World AIDS Day. In the 35 years of the epidemic, about 80 million people have become infected with HIV and nearly 40 million have died. And in northern Nigeria, Boko Haram suicide bombers are blamed for attacks today in the capital cities of Borno and Yobe states. Coming up, we'll have music from Gabon, and in our feature segment, moving with intensity to find better treatments and a vaccine for Ebola. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're tipping off today with kudos for my favorite, or I should say one of my favorite basketball players. The other is my daughter.
Well, that's good. I mean, yeah. Those are two good players right there, Kim. Yes, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute, Kim, to Los Angeles Lakers basketball star Kobe Bryant, who reached a big career milestone Sunday night. Kobe turned in an excellent all-around performance, scoring 31 points, grabbing 11 rebounds, and passing for 12 assists in a 129-122 overtime victory over the visiting Toronto Raptors. In the process, Kobe became the first player in NBA history to reach 30,000 points and 6,000 assists in a career. Now, it was only the fourth win of the season for Kobe and the struggling Lakers, who have 13 losses and are in last place in the NBA's Pacific Division. The Lakers will be back on the court later tonight against the host Detroit Pistons, and then they travel here to Washington to play my favorite club, the Washington Wizards.
They're playing back.
In African club football, Sewe Sport of Ivory Coast defeated visiting Al Ahly of Egypt 2-1 in Abidjan in the first leg of the CAF Confederation Cup final. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shegun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, has more details for us, as well as other football news.
Good evening, Africa. Home team Sewe Sport defeated Egyptian giant Al Ahly 2-1. Taking a very slim advantage into the second leg in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Christian Kofi Kwame and Roger Asali scored for the Ivorian club, while Mahmoud Hassan scored an important away goal for Al Ahly. The return leg will be played in Cairo on December 6th. Sewe Sport is seeking to become the first Ivorian club to win Continental Club Championship since 1998. On the other hand, Al Ahly is seeking to become the first Egyptian club to win the CAF Confederation Cup. Al Ahly holds the record of most victories in Africa's other club football competition, the more prestigious CAF Champions League, with 8 titles. It has also won 6 CAF Super Cup, which pitches the winners of Africa's 2 club football competitions. The winner of the CAF Confederation Cup will pocket $660,000 and will also face the winner of the CAF Champions League in the 2015 CAF Super Cup. Staying with African football, there is bad news for Ghana ahead of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations due to start on January 17th in Equatorial Guinea. Ghana international Kwadwo Asamoah has been ruled out of the competition. Asamoah's Italian club Juventus ruled him out of the tournament after announcing he will undergo knee surgery that will sideline him for up to 3 months. The Ghana international missed training with his club on Friday and will fly to Barcelona, Spain, on Tuesday in order to have surgery to repair cartilage in his left knee. He had been complaining of persistent knee pain, according to a statement on the club's official website. Last week, Ghana named Israeli trainer Avram Grant to succeed Kwesi Appiah as coach of the Black Stars, as Ghana's national team is known. Ghana Football Association President Kwesi Nyatachi said the new coach has been charged with the task of, quote, doing well at the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations and winning the 2017 tournament, unquote. Nyatachi also revealed that Grant would be assisted by Maxwell Konadu, who was named as caretaker coach after Appiah parted company with the GFA. And from Cameroon comes the report that the Emergency Committee of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has allowed the postponement of the elections of the Cameroon Football Association, FECAFOOT. The elections, which were scheduled for November 29th, will now take place by February 28, 2015, at the latest. The Emergency Committee said it has also extended the mandate of the Normalization Committee accordingly, and that the elections should take place according to the new statutes adopted on August 23, 2014. The committee said the decisions were made based on feedback from the Cameroonian authorities, who had expressed concern over security ahead of the upcoming FECAFOOT elections. Away from African football, the health of Brazilian soccer legend Pele continued to improve on Saturday, although he remained in intensive care units to allow doctors to monitor a urinary tract infection. The 74-year-old three-time World Cup champion is receiving renal support treatment to help his kidneys filter waste products from his blood. He underwent surgery earlier this month to remove kidney stones. Pele has struggled with many health problems over the past decade. He has had emergency eye surgery for a detached retina and a hip replacement. Known in Brazil as the King of Soccer, he played in four World Cups and scored over 1,000 goals during his career. Finally, World Cup champion Germany says it will play the United States in an exhibition game on June 10, 2015 in Cologne. Germany's football governing body announced the date and venue on its website. Germany beat the United States 1-0 in its final group stage match at the 2014 FIFA World Cup before going ahead to win the title. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
The voice of America.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the voice of America. Now let's go to Malabo, the capital of Equatorial Guinea. That's where the Confederation of African Football, CAF, will hold the draw Wednesday for its 2015 Nations Cup tournament. The 16 qualifiers are, in alphabetical order, Algeria, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Cape Verde, Congo-Brazzaville, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, Ghana, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Mali, Senegal, South Africa, Tunisia, and Zambia. Our African football guru, David Legg, says with nine former champions in the field, it's shaping up as a very competitive Nations Cup kicking off January 17th in Equatorial Guinea.
Those 16 qualifiers, Sonny, they will be divided into four groups of four in terms of seeding. And what then happens is each country plays the other three teams in the group once. The top two countries in each group will go forward to the quarterfinals. So you'll have your four quarterfinals, then obviously your two semifinals. And then, of course, ultimately, you have the final. And I'm looking forward to the tournament, Sonny, on the one hand, but I'm also a bit nervous because I keep looking at this list of qualifiers, and it is so difficult to pick potential champions. I just see so many teams. I mean, some of the football played by Guinea against Uganda in Casablanca was beautiful to watch. Lovely one-touch passing. The South Africans, potentially, they could be strong challengers if they can continue from where they left off in Uyo. And there are so many other countries like Ghana, long overdue a success. Algeria, out to prove they are the number one team in Africa. You've got Ivory Coast, after so many failures when they were the favorites, could they now sort of defy logic and win it when they're not the favorites? And so on and so forth. The Zambians, can they bounce back after disappointing 2013?
Yes, David, some very interesting Nations Cup storylines indeed. And we look forward to you breaking down the draw for us later this week, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny, sunny, Babani, yes, Sunny Side of Sports, it's a program. Sunny, sunny, Babani, yes, Sunny Side of Sports, it's a program. Sunny, sunny, Babani, yes, Sunny Side of Sports, it's a program.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. More National Basketball Association news now. The Memphis Grizzlies beat the Sacramento Kings Sunday 97-85 to improve their record to 15 victories and 2 defeats. That's the best record in the NBA. Zach Randolph had 22 points and 12 rebounds, and Marc Gasol added 18 points and 6 rebounds to help the Grizzlies hold off a late rally by the Kings. It was the 5th straight win for Memphis. And finally, the New England Revolution will play the Los Angeles Galaxy in the MLS Cup. That's the championship match in Major League Soccer next weekend. The teams met once in the regular season, with the Galaxy winning 5-1. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, moving with intensity to find better treatments and a vaccine for Ebola. And next, efforts being taken to reduce drunk driving-related accidents in Kenya. But first, some music. Here is Oliver Ngoma with Posse.
Yeah.
liver and goma with PASI.
Well, intense efforts to find better treatments and a vaccine for Ebola are moving ahead at one researcher describes as warp speed. Clinical trials for three potential treatments will start in early December at Ebola clinics in Liberia and Guinea. In Mali, researchers are testing a vaccine and expect results from the Phase 1 human trial in late December. VOA's Anne Look has the latest.
Health workers in West Africa are still struggling to get suspected Ebola patients to come forward and go into isolation at treatment units or ETUs so they won't infect others. It's been a hard sell, in part because those ETUs can't actually offer much in the way of treatment. There is currently no cure for Ebola. Clinics in West Africa can give supportive care, like rehydration therapy, to help the patient's bodies fight off the virus. But Ebola kills between 50 and 80% of those infected. However, that picture could be improving. In December, scientists will begin testing three possible treatments for Ebola at clinics in Guinea and Liberia, run by Doctors Without Borders. They will be testing two antiviral drugs, as well as a treatment using the blood and plasma of Ebola survivors, whose antibodies may help other patients fight off the virus. MSF says these trials are, quote, accelerated and mark unprecedented international collaboration. Still, MSF Medical Director Annick Antieren says don't expect a miracle cure just yet.
On espère évidemment que ce soit des traitements qui aient une vraie valeur ajoutée. Le produit miracle, ça semble.
She says any treatment will be more effective when it's given early, before the virus spreads everywhere in the body. But not all patients come in during the first 48 hours. But these trials are just the beginning. She says there are other drugs they can test. People evacuated and treated in the U.S. and Europe have been getting combinations of treatments. So that's an option as well. New Ebola cases are being reported every day in West Africa. This epidemic is far from over. Still, thoughts are already turning to the future, to the next outbreak. There is talk of ramped-up surveillance and the creation of rapid response units that could go into the bush at the first signs. The WHO has called for the development of a rapid diagnostic tool, a simple test that could give results in 30 minutes without the need of a lab. Liberia's Assistant Health Minister, Tolbert Nyansua.
Unless we can get a vaccine to immunize people against the disease and eradicate the disease, it will be a disease that will always come back because we have the history in other countries in East Africa.
The Democratic Republic of Congo just beat its seventh Ebola outbreak since the disease was first discovered there in 1976. Uganda has had five outbreaks since 2000. In West Africa this year, Ebola spread in a way never before seen, on a scale never before seen. The virus reached urban areas like Monrovia. It traveled by plane to the U.S. and Europe, sparking global alarm. That alarm and the epidemic in West Africa spurred on what had been stalled research efforts. Dr. Myron Levine of the Center for Vaccine Development at the University of Maryland is working on a vaccine trial in Mali. He says it typically takes about a decade to get a vaccine tested and licensed for general use. But this is uncharted territory.
We've already kind of done the impossible. And lots of folks said there's no way that we could go from a vaccine in August that had never been in a human being and complete dose response phase one in West Africans within a few months. They said it was impossible. Well, impossible, you can cross out that word. It's been done.
Researchers have finished injecting the last of 91 Malian health workers with a test vaccine against the Zaire strain of the virus. The 91 volunteers were given varying doses and are being monitored. Their immune responses will, quote, peak 28 days post-injection. Results are expected at the end of December. If all goes well, a larger trial testing the efficacy of the vaccine is expected to start as soon as the first quarter of 2015. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
Okay.
Kenyan roads claim more than 3,000 fatalities each year. In a bid to reduce drunk driving-related accidents, breathalyzers have been deployed throughout the country. A special task force has been charged with ensuring the roads are kept free from those who violate the law, and authorities say it seems to be paying off. Lenny Ruvaga has more from Nairobi.
It is 10 p.m. along one of Kenya's busiest highways, Jogoo Road in Nairobi. Police have set up a roadblock to conduct random checks for intoxicated drivers. Breathalyzers, which measure blood alcohol content from air expelled from a person's mouth, were first introduced in Kenya 3 years ago to curb a steep increase in drunken driving accidents and deaths. A breathalyzer kit such as this one costs approximately $2,000. And the National Transport and Safety Authority has deployed 12 kits throughout the country. The NTSA works in tandem with the Kenyan police, so police cannot solicit bribes from drivers caught intoxicated. Cosmas Ngesu from the NTSA says this approach helps with enforcement of drunk driving laws.
But we have also done it. We are partnered with the Kenya Anti-Corruption Commission. We also monitor this operation, send their people. So we are checking on issues of corruption.
Since January alone, more than 3,000 people have died on Kenyan roads, with 80% of those deaths attributed to drunken driving. Ngesu says those figures represent a drop from just a few years ago, and he says the public is getting the intended message from the police breathalyzer checks.
We used to record a high level of crashes, particularly over the weekend and months, caused by people driving from pubs drunk. But since we started, the statistics have gone down. Additionally, we have created awareness. Now many people choose to take taxis home after drinking instead of drinking and driving. So the awareness is created.
And this is why George Karau looks forward to the weekend, when he can catch up with friends over drinks after a long week and not worry about driving home. He is a client of Smart Fellas, a cab company which caters to clients who are over the legal alcohol limits. Within an hour's notice, they will meet you at the bar or restaurant and drive you home in your own car for an affordable membership fee of $20 to $50 per year. Karau says he signed up as soon as he heard of the service.
Road carnage has been a main concern for everyone. And so when you have a service like this, you have the option of still having a good time and getting home in one piece without causing any accidents. And it's not a service for the rich people per se. Anybody can use the service.
The taxi fees are cheaper than getting caught on the road intoxicated and having to go to court. Those found guilty of drunk driving face fines of up to $1,000 and 2 years in jail. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhim in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month, the world celebrates a natural resource that provides employment opportunities for 50 million people and food for billions. Fisheries. World Fisheries Day, established in 1998 and celebrated annually on November 21st, highlights the importance of protecting the oceans and conserving marine life. President Barack Obama and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry have made environmental sustainability a priority of U.S. foreign policy. They recognize the linkages between fisheries, food security, economic welfare, and people's health worldwide. In Africa, where more than 200 million people eat fish as a main source of protein, sustainable fishing is critical. The economic potential is also great. The fisheries sector employs more than 12 million Africans, and fish is a leading export, with an annual value of nearly $3 billion. Fisheries provide government revenues through fishing agreements and license fees from foreign fishing fleets, which also drive economic activity in regional ports. Protecting marine environments isn't just about fish, it's about people. Despite the resource's great importance, its health and sustainability face increasing challenges. Illegal and unregulated fishing is a major environmental problem and a form of wildlife trafficking. West African fisheries, one of the most diverse and economically important in the world, lose over $1 billion a year this way. The United States stands side by side with our African partners in addressing fisheries issues. 11 African countries joined nearly 90 nations at the Our Ocean Conference, hosted by Secretary Kerry in June, where sustainable fisheries were one of the key themes discussed. In September, Secretary Kerry joined Mozambican Foreign Minister Oldemiro Baloy and Director General of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, José Graciano, in hosting a follow-on meeting on the margins of the UN General Assembly. We applaud Gabon's announcement this month to create a 46,000 square kilometer network of marine protected areas in its waters. This bold step shows Gabon's strong commitment to marine habitats, important species, and local livelihoods. African countries also were key voices in developing the Port State Measures Agreement, an international treaty that will make it harder for fishing vessels to land illegal catches at ports around the world, ensuring that countries profit from fish caught in their waters. From providing food to generating income to keeping marine ecosystems healthy, fish are an indispensable natural resource. The United States is committed to improving fisheries management, protecting the ocean, and safeguarding this marine bounty for generations to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Malaria stops footballers from scoring and children from learning. Join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Join with leaders like President Museveni.
United, we can beat malaria.